You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. The Republican National Convention wrapped up last night in Milwaukee, where former President Trump accepted the party's nomination and gave the keynote address. Producer Mackenzie Crummy has been bringing us the sounds of the convention all week here on Wisconsin Today. Last night, she was outside the Fiserv Forum talking with attendees during and after Trump's speech.
My name is Ken Brown, and I live in Racine, Wisconsin, and I've lived in Wisconsin for about 35 years.
What's your reaction so far?
I was actually a little bit more subdued than I expected the president to be after his years of... I actually just texted all my friends. I'd like to see a little bit more bombast. I'm sure it's going to come here in the last few minutes, but, you know, it's clearly reflective of the fact that he was shot and that life, I mean, that's like a half an inch away from ending your life. I mean, anybody, I don't care who you are, that's just going to be like, okay. But I still got to do this job. I think he's still the right person to do this job. He certainly did a great job, and I didn't even like him in 2016. I voted for him, but I didn't really like him. And I shut my mouth for 6 months, and I said, all right, let's see what he does. And I saw all the things that he struggled with and trying to figure out how the system works because he was an outsider. And it took him a while, but he finally got his his hands under him, and he said, okay, this is what we got to do. And he did a lot of fantastic things because he was the outsider. And there's our bombast right there.
Tom Sweeney, La Crosse, Wisconsin.
What did you think of the speech?
Thought it was awesome.
Yeah.
Trump, Trump, Trump.
A lot of high energy.
He was very subdued. Wasn't a lot of rah, 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 but he was making all the points that needed to be made.
Can you describe your hat for me?
It's a cheese head. It's a cheddar. I'm a cheese head wearing a cheddar head. I'm a cheese head wearing a cheddar head.
Brandon, Appleton, Wisconsin.
How have things been going so far? Fantastic. What's your reaction?
Things are fantastic. Energy's high. Confidence is good. The message is, I think, well-deserved and... yeah, much needed.
Have you been here all 4 days?
Three.
Three?
Yeah.
And what stuck out to you the most?
I would say just the overall positivity of not just the attendees and the leadership, but also the attitude in the city. We were talking to a lot of people within the community, and they seemed to be well receptive and excited that, Republicans are here.
Did that surprise you?
A little, yeah.
Because Milwaukee is known to be a pretty blue city.
For sure. But, an open mind is, and an open heart is a good thing. And the world needs more of that.
Starting on August 19th, the Democratic Party will hold its convention in Chicago. We'll cover that event through WPR's news department and here on Wisconsin Today. Now, residents in Pierce County in northwestern Wisconsin spoke out at a public hearing last week against the proposed expansion of a concentrated animal feeding operation, or CAFO. Ridge Breeze Dairy in the town of Salem is seeking DNR approval to more than triple the size of its farm to house more than 6,000 cows. The company tried to assure local residents that the move wouldn't pose a threat to the environment, but groundwater quality and the company's own history were concerns for many in attendance. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. She was at this public hearing. Danny, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks, Rob.
Can you give us a sense of where this farm is located in its local watershed, how significant this expansion would be there?
Yeah, so Ridge Breeze Dairy is located in Maiden Rock in Pierce County, and that lies within the Rush River watershed, which drains into the Mississippi River at Lake Pepin. And so, if you're traveling by car, it's about a dozen miles from the Mississippi River. And this expansion would be pretty big. Right now, the dairy operates about 1,700 cows, and the owner wants to expand to about 6,500 cows. So it would be just under four times its current size and generate about 78 million gallons of manure each year. And it wants to add those cows by the end of next year.
Now, sometimes you think public hearing might be a sleepy occasion, not a lot of people. Paint us a picture. What did this hearing look like?
Well, and I want to note that I joined this hearing virtually, Rob, so I can't really speak to what it looked like in the room.
Gotcha.
But there were a lot of concerns voiced at the hearing, and I would say that the main ones were about the farm's potential effects on nearby waterways and groundwater, as well as the amount of land that they have available to spread their manure. And while many said that they support farmers and farming, a lot of people who spoke in opposition said, this isn't a farm, it's a factory. And they brought up concerns with the owner of this CAFO, and that's Ridge Breeze Dairy Group. That business owns 5 farms in Wisconsin, and opponents say that the group has a poor track record of handling manure at its operations.
Can you talk a little more about that track record? People brought up concerns, I understand, about past manure spills at some of the farms they own.
Yeah, since 2013, its operations have had at least 11 manure spills, according to DNR records. There were some other spills, but they didn't relate to manure. But they released basically a total of more than 192,000 gallons of manure through these 11 spills. And that includes about 100,000 gallons that were released at Pine Breeze Dairy in Washera County in 2017. And Ridge Breeze itself, you know, this group bought this from the previous owner, which was Sumbo Farms. And since it acquired the farm, there have been some issues of noncompliance. And those have included issues related to field runoff and wastewater violations.
Talking to WPR reporter Danielle Kading about a proposed CAFO expansion in northwestern Wisconsin's Pierce County, Ridge Breeze Dairy, hoping to more than triple the size of its farm to about 6,500 cows. What have we heard from Breeze Dairy operators of the farm? You had some quotes from Greg Wolf, the CEO.
Yeah, you know, when I talked to him about people's concerns that were brought up at the meeting, you know, he said that they've taken on some operations that have had past issues, but overall he felt that they run good operations. And he basically said that, you know, their history isn't perfect, but whatever issues that they've had in the past, that they've worked with the DNR and other regulators to make sure that they have corrected their mistakes. And he noted with that Pine Breeze spill and in particular, that stemmed from a mechanical malfunction, that they invested significant funds to ensure that that would never happen again.
At the hearing, some of the residents, including an attorney from the group of Midwest Environmental Advocates, wanted the DNR to be able to require groundwater monitoring on the site. Can the DNR do that? What kind of legal authority does it have?
Yes, the DNR can do that, and mostly it can do that because of a 2021 Supreme Court ruling here in Wisconsin, which involved a case of another large livestock farm in Kewaunee County, which, if you recall, has had significant issues with nitrate contamination. And if I could just step back real quick and talk about nitrate contamination, that was one of the things that people brought up in the meeting, was that, you know, there are already private wells in the area of this CAFO that have had elevated levels of nitrate, which can stem from the use of nitrogen fertilizers and manure. And the last well report that I found for Pierce County in 2022 showed about 12% of wells sampled in that area had levels higher than the federal health standard. And that's important because nitrates are a contaminant that have been known to cause blue baby syndrome and other health issues like thyroid disease and colon cancer. And so with this, going back to this 2021 ruling that gave the DNR this authority, you know, they ruled in the DNR's favor in this case because they think it's important that they have the ability to require groundwater monitoring on large farms to protect water quality. But however, you know, there's been some farms that have sued the agency whenever it's attempted to require monitoring wells at their sites since then. And for this particular farm, Ridge Breeze Dairy, the owner, Greg Wolf, said he doesn't think groundwater monitoring is necessary for the expansion.
And a related concern that came up at the public hearing, Danny, the amount of the land that the farm has compared to the amount of manure it would have to spread with 6,500 plus head of dairy cows. Can you explain that for us?
Yeah, sure. So once this expansion is complete, this operation would produce 78 million gallons of manure each year. And one group called Grassroots Organizing Western Wisconsin, or GROW, had said that or at least pointed out that the DNR is not allowing the farm to spread manure on about 1,200 acres that the farm has under agreements because it has not yet undergone required soil testing. And then the group also said that there are roughly 300 more acres that should be removed from the farm's nutrient management plan or all the lands that they submitted as part of, you know, spreading that manure on fields because landowners said that they don't have agreements with the farm. But the owner of Ridge Breeze Dairy is saying that they would conduct any required soil sampling before any manure is spread on the lands in question, that not all of the manure created each year is spread on farm fields. Some of it's stored in manure stores, storage pits. And as for the lack of those agreements, Greg Wolf said that some landowners rent their land to other farmers for growing crops and that they would work out agreements with those farmers to supply manure necessary for growing corn or soybeans on those lands. So there's kind of a dispute about that. And for Grow, that group wants the DNR to require Ridge Breeze Dairy to provide signed and notarized agreements with landowners to prove that they do in fact have the land necessary for spreading all of their manure.
In our last half a minute, Danny, what's next in the approval process for this expansion?
Yeah, so yesterday was the last day to submit comments to the DNR on this proposed expansion, and now the agency is going to take all of that input and incorporate it into its decision-making process as they issue a final determination of whether or not to modify that CAFO's existing permit and allow the expansion.
Danny, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior. She talked with us about a public hearing this week on a proposed expansion for a large dairy farm in Pierce County in northwestern Wisconsin. Are you part of that story? Are you following it? Are you participating? Or is this issue a concern wherever you are in the state? Email us about it. WisconsinToday@WPR.org. That's WisconsinToday@WPR.org. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, Wisconsin researchers find connections between the media people consume and attitudes toward the economy.
There's this huge effect coming from the right-wing media ecosystem that's changing people's perceptions in a way that's divorced from economic reality.
New insights about partisan divides, that's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. In the run-up to the presidential election, we hear President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump making their cases on the good and the bad of the current U.S. economy. But the way we view our economy might be shaped by the types of media we consume. A new study finds that people who consumed more conservative media carried a more negative view of the economy. Well, the opposite was true among people who paid attention to the more mainstream sources of news. The authors of that study talked to Kate Archer Kent. Mark Koplovich is a professor in the Department of Political Science and La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. And Mike Wagner is a professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison. Mike begins by introducing us to the things that make up the information economy.
So we're talking about the kinds of news that people consume. So do they consume more mainstream traditional news like you might hear on Wisconsin Public Radio or in a major newspaper or network television news or more conservative news like Fox News, Breitbart, you know, the kind of more right-leaning or far-right-wing media sources or more left-leaning like MSNBC, the Huffington Post and those sorts of things. And so we think about the information economy as a set of news, but we also think about it as who we talk to about politics and how we think about our own behavior on social media and how do the interaction of those kinds of things work together to affect our attitudes about what we think is true, our attitudes about the economy in this case, and how those attitudes might be related to things like approval of the president.
That's a very large orbit of influence. Mark, can you outline this relationship between what we're consuming and our view of the economy?
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, one of the big motivations for this project that Mike and I are working on is there's this gap now that hasn't existed in decades between the state of the real economy, right? If you think about unemployment, inflation, labor force participation, job growth, whether the economy is in a recession, right? By all of those metrics, the U.S. economy is actually doing incredibly well now and much, much better than our rich country peers around the world. But Americans, in terms of sentiment, think the economy is doing terribly. So poll after poll shows this. The University of Michigan has a consumer sentiment survey that they've been doing for decades, and sentiment is lower than it's ever been. And it used to be in the past that consumer sentiment and, you know, public perceptions of the economy would decline when the economy was bad in material terms, and then it would go back up when the economy was doing better. And now what's happened in the last decade is that, especially the last couple of years, is there's a very wide gap. Right. And so that was really the motivation for us in this project, is to try and understand what's going on there. Why do people think the economy is not doing well when by all of these material metrics, the economy actually seems to be doing very well?
When do we become more entrenched in our thinking with all of these outside forces at work?
Typically, the more your information diet is one-sided, so the more Republicans just watch Fox News, just listen to conservative talk radio, and just talk to Republicans, or the more Democrats just watch MSNBC, just read the Huffington Post, just talk to Democrats, the more entrenched our views become, and the more likely we don't think that the other side is even, you know, appropriate to deal with. We might be more likely to stop talking to people altogether. We might be more likely to cut them out of our lives. We might be more likely to impugn their motives and not be open to their points of view. And so the more entrenched our talk networks and our information use networks, the more polarized, the more extreme we tend to become, and the more certain, unfortunately, we tend to become in our preferences.
One thing I noticed, Mark, in your charts and graphs was that the Wall Street Journal talked about the economy a lot, and how you said that, you know, as there was a lot of this hand-wringing in 2021 about a potential recession, a potential downturn, and you just heard that those stories after story after story. You know, the Wall Street Journal, though, that's its bread and butter, is talking about the economy. What did you see there in your research that applies not only to that outlet, but to others in terms of, you know, just continual stories about the economy?
Yeah, no, it wasn't just the Journal. It was, you know, looking across all media outlets. So what I saw in 2022 and 2023 was, if you look across, if you go on LexisNexis and you search for articles about inflation, and articles about recession, articles about economic recovery, articles about unemployment, the ratio of articles across all media was overwhelmingly 10 to 1, 15 to 1 coverage of inflation and recession. And not coverage of what you might think of as the good news, which is the really historically low unemployment rate, very strong job growth. We just had the fastest economic recovery since World War II. You know, the economy dropped out during COVID, and then within 24 months, we're basically back to full employment, compared to the global financial crisis in 2008, where it took us a full decade to get back to full employment. So that really got us thinking about the information economy, right? It's not just the Journal. It might be the Journal relative to the New York Times or the Washington Post was covering inflation and recession more, right? But even the quote unquote, you know, left wing or more mainstream outlets were still saw that imbalance across all of media. So that got us thinking about this sentiment gap that I was thinking about before, is that maybe it's not just material factors. It's not my personal income situation, my employment status, those sorts of things. But, you know, it's also this information economy that is driving what people are thinking about the economy.
But, Mike, shouldn't it be our individual experiences, our day-to-day finances, painting us the picture for us, regardless of what these media outlets are telling us?
Typically, that's been what we've seen more consistently since we've measured this as a set of scholars, you know, around the globe. There's been a pretty tight connection between the actual economy and people's perceptions about it. And a couple of years ago, that began to change dramatically. Now, it's not the case that people's financial experiences don't matter at all. And it's not the case that the actual economic performance doesn't matter at all. It's that all of a sudden there's this huge effect coming from the right-wing media ecosystem that's changing people's perceptions in a way that's divorced from economic reality. Like right now, the Brewers are in first place by 4.5 games, I think. And some people will take that and say, this is good news for the Brewers. Others are like, oh, they're terrible. They should be up by 8 games. This is not good. You know, and so there's always, you know, there's a reality and then there's people's perceptions of it. And especially we might imagine that people who listen to really negative sports talk radio shows might have the most negative attitudes about the Brewers. And that same kind of thing is happening here, where people who are in a right-wing media ecosystem have attitudes that are more different as compared to the actual state of the economy than everybody else's attitudes. Now, it's not that, again, it's not that the reality doesn't matter. It's that all of a sudden this media ecosystem also matters. And as Mark was saying, the amount of attention given to inflation, given how much of it's an actual problem, you know, is really different, really kind of, you know, asymmetric, you know, in more academic terms. And so that's one of the things that's driving our interest in this project.
Yeah. And one of the things that is really striking in our results is, as Mike said, you do find with inflation, your personal financial situation is a huge determinant. With unemployment, if you're unemployed, you're much more concerned about unemployment. But the media variables, the effects of those on people's opinions are at least as big. And that was the really surprising part. The other surprising thing for me, you know, Mike lives in the world of political communication and information, and I study the politics of the world economy. The literatures that I focus on, you know, for the last 15, 20 years now, it's these material factors and what we call sociotropic concerns, which is, do you understand basically how macroeconomics or the economy works? And we tend to correlate that very strongly with education. Right. So we included all of the demographic variables and material factors and sociotropic factors that traditionally explain people's public opinion about the economy. And almost all of them don't matter. Or the effects are very, very small.
So not how much education you have, demographics, where you live.
Yeah, race. Do you own a home? We thought would be very big because of interest rates. The other thing is we spent so much time talking about gas prices in 2022.
Right.
And we asked people, do you commute to work and how far do you commute? And those variables were not significant at all across all of the models that we run. So that for me was the really striking thing. It's not just that the information variables matter, but that they seem to be the single largest determinant of what people think about the economy.
Mark Koplovich is here. Mike Wagner, they are UW-Madison professors, recently publishing a new study looking at how the media we consume influences our views on the economy, especially now ahead of the 2024 election. Mike, should the media talk about or report about the economy differently? Is there a way it can be better presented?
I think any time that the news media can report in context, so inflation is this percent, how does that compare to last month? How does that compare to last year? How does that compare to 5 years ago? That's really useful for people, right? To know, like to hear inflation is up 2%. Oh, gosh, maybe things are terrible. But maybe in context, that's actually pretty good. And so, or what's the unemployment rate and how does it relate to the prior presidential administration and the one before that? And so looking at coverage in context, I think, really matters. It's also, I think, important for news organizations to push back on people who are making claims that are demonstrably false. And so one thing that often happens in news coverage, especially in kind of national news, is that there are two sides to every story, no matter how many sides there are to the verifiable truth. And so when we hear one side saying things are terrible and one side saying things are improving, reporters can often say, well, I'm unbiased. I've now told, you know, this both sides story. Lots of journalists push back against that both sidesism and do a better job of reporting than maybe we saw 10, 15, 20 years ago. But there's that muscle, that muscle memory of, well, gosh, the president or candidate for president said the economy is terrible. What, are we not going to report faithfully that this person running for high office is saying this thing? And so reporting that, but also then reflecting back to reality, I think, is something that can really help.
How do you see media coverage of the economy impacting the 2024 presidential race?
Traditionally, and I write a book with a political scientist named Beth Tice Morris about elections. And so every 4 years we write a book about the presidential election. And for 75 years, the economic growth in July before the election was a huge determinant of which party ended up winning the White House. You know, if the economy was good, the White House stayed in that party. Economy's bad, White House flips the partisan control. And it matters less. It mattered less in 2020 and 2016. And I imagine that it might again. And part of it, I think, is that split Mark was talking about before between the real economy and the perceived economy really takes off in 2020. And so we've had several years now where the truth on the ground isn't as important as it used to be in affecting our attitudes about the economy, but also about the president. And economic approval or economic attitudes and presidential approval tend to be pretty tightly correlated, but less so now. And so the better job that the news media might do in telling us the truth, the more that relationship might return.
And Mike mentioned this issue of context, right? So one of the things we did in the study was an experiment where we gave half the people who took the survey out of 2,000 global context. So we gave them information not just about inflation in the United States, but also across all of the G7 advanced industrialized countries. And then we also gave them some information we did the survey in August of 2022. At that point, most of the inflation was being caused by the energy shock and the food price shock from the war in Ukraine. Whereas most of the political rhetoric and media coverage in the U.S. had been about Joe Biden's fiscal policy and kind of U.S. domestic focus factors that were driving inflation. And that had a really interesting effect because it differed across parties, right? And I really think it helps us understand piercing the information bubble. So Republicans or more Republican-leaning respondents became less concerned about inflation and unemployment and recession when you gave them that global context. Democratic respondents or more Democratic respondents became more concerned, right? And there's different ways to think about that, but I think our interpretation of that is piercing the information bubble, right? So if you consumed primarily right-wing media, probably the only thing you heard, right, for 2 years was the Democrats and Joe Biden caused all of the inflation. And now here's information that you're telling me it's a global phenomenon and there are things that may be beyond the U.S. government's control. And Democrats in the other direction probably heard, you know, the good things about Joe Biden's fiscal policy and the American Rescue Plan. Maybe I think the Democrats have this under control, but now again, you're telling me it's a global problem.
Gosh, there's a war in Ukraine. It's causing all these other problems. And so now it's not just Biden's plans. It's these other things.
Yeah. So I think this, you know, when we think about context, as Mike said, it's really important. But there's a domestic context aspect to it as well as an international context.
And Mark, as you say, you study the politics of the world economy. You've given presentations on this type of study in Italy and Germany, elsewhere. How do you find that adding more global economic concerns affect people's opinions of our economy and people's opinions in other countries? I mean, is this phenomena happening elsewhere in the world?
Right. So we're really interested in this question of does it travel to other places?
Yeah.
And I just got back from a year in Berlin, and so I presented this work in progress in Germany and other countries in Europe. And the general reaction is, yes, of course, this is also happening here. But the media ecosystems are very different.
In what way?
People watch local news. There are a handful of national news networks and people watch the nightly news. There's a small number of national and regional papers, and most people under 50 or 45 read them. So, and there's no Fox News equivalent yet. Right. So it's a much more historically traditional media ecosystem that doesn't look like the U.S. today, where, you know, everybody is getting their information off of social media. People are getting their information now From TikTok, et cetera, mm-hmm. as well as from the right-wing talk radio and Fox News. There's a small amount of that in Germany, but it's much, much different.
It's harder to live in an echo chamber in Germany with respect to information than it is in the United States.
Right. And so we're interested, you know, does this travel? Do you see the same media effects? Do you see the same political talking partner effects? Because if you're talking to people, even if they have different political views, but they're consuming the same information, right, you might have a different dynamic at play.
So as we begin to wrap up here, Mike, what are you watching for in media coverage of the economy moving forward, especially on the short term as we head into November?
I think one of the things I'm watching the most for is when a candidate for president or Senate makes a claim about the overall state of the economy that's false or maybe even misleading but not wholly false. Lots of things are true in some circumstances but not others. How much do reporters and other, you know, actors in the news media push back on those claims or at least offer corrective objective information about the inflation level, the unemployment level, the inequality gap, wage growth, those kinds of things? And so when a person says, you know, the economy is terrible, maybe push them to say, well, what exactly do you mean? Inflation is down, unemployment is low. What thing are you talking about in particular? And so holding folks to more specific answers and providing additional context are, I think, important things.
Thank you both for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having us.
That was Mike Wagner, professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison, and Mark Koplovich, professor in the Department of Political Science and the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. They spoke with Kate Archer Kent about their new study looking at how our views of the economy can be shaped by the types of media we consume. Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, it's the Dachshund Derby coming up here in Wisconsin.
They look like little lightning machines, just like they've been shot out of a cannon, and they just go because they want their squeaky toy back.
We've all been there. That's up next here on Wisconsin Today from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about family just ahead of the Summer Olympic Games in Paris, which start in a week.
The world's best athletes will soon be descending upon the Olympic Games. Watching thousands of runners, swimmers, and gymnasts enter the stadium for the opening ceremony is electric. But then, when you think about all the people who helped those athletes succeed and get them to where they are now, that's inspiring. Nancy Jorgensen is one of those people behind the scenes. The Waukesha writer and mother tells us about raising an Olympian.
When people ask how I parented a world-class athlete, I say I created an Olympian by not trying to create an Olympian. So how did I raise my daughter Gwen Jorgensen to be the Rio 2016 gold medalist in triathlon? What do I recommend? Don't underestimate the quiet ones. With an outgoing older sibling, Gwen often deferred to her sister. Hamburgers or hot dogs, library or park, swing or slide, Gwen went along. Until third grade, when she discovered her passion for swimming. Then, Gwen didn't let anyone tell her how to spend her time. She would be in the pool. Practice spelling. As a high school teacher, who never dreamed Gwen would be a professional athlete, I believed academics would serve her best. So she and I practiced spelling words. Today, Gwen is no orthographer, but she usually spells correctly for her 100,000 Instagram followers. Being a sports figure in the social media age requires more than physical prowess. Be skeptical of early success. I observed parents glom onto a glimmer of talent and try to produce a star. Any attempt like that with Gwen's freestyle would have backfired. Although swimming was her favorite sport, it wasn't her strongest. She tried and failed to win a state title, then tried and failed to ignite a running career. It took her a decade to combine swim, bike, and run into triathlon. Buy a violin. Mastering Bach's Minuet in G meant working with a coach, playing in a group, and leading a group. Skills Gwen eventually applied to sports. But violin also created a distraction from Gwen's preoccupation with swimming, and I preferred a well-rounded Gwen to an obsessed Gwen. Reward assertiveness. On our commutes to orchestra, Gwen bargained. If you make me go to orchestra, then you have to take me to the YMCA to make up my swim session. I admired her dedication and, most weeks, made that extra trip to the Y. Focus on friendships. Gwen spent so many hours in the pool, I suggested she go to a movie just to have fun. Mom, she said, rolling her eyes, I am having fun. All my friends are in the pool. Then, as now, Gwen's friends were also her competitors. She still gathers inspiration from her friends' achievements. She works with competitors, so both she and they fine-tune their best. Celebrate wins. From the beginning, Gwen found fault with her races. Are you ever happy with a result, I said. Once in sixth grade I had a good race, she told me. I failed to teach her how to be happy. And only in her 20s, when a mentor coached her to celebrate the process rather than the outcome, did she discover joy. Offer to cook, clean, and babysit. At 38, Gwen is now a working mother of two boys. Her office is the pool, the road, and the world stage. I no longer make decisions for her. Now I just help out. When she travels to Yokohama or Hamburg or Havana, I fly from Wisconsin to her home in Colorado to cook, clean, and help care for Stanley and George. Gwen offers her boys an array of activities, from music to reptile camp to taekwondo to cycling. Stanley, at 6, has a penchant for bicycles and remote control cars. George, at 18 months, plays, hoards, and sleeps with Hot Wheels cars. No one suggests a professional pursuit for either of them. We just let the kids play.
Nancy Jorgensen is a writer who lives in Waukesha. She's also the mother of Gwen Jorgensen, a 2-time Olympian and gold medalist in the triathlon. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now for a side note on the Jorgensen family in Waukesha. Mom Nancy, who we just heard from, and daughter Elizabeth wrote a family memoir in 2020 called Go Gwen Go, and they talked with WPR when it came out.
It's about the different emotions that their family felt as they watched their Olympian compete.
As the support, you have no control.
That's Elizabeth, sister of 2016 Olympic gold triathlete Gwen Jorgensen.
Gwen has done all the preparation, and she's the one that can control every scenario, and we can't. We're just in the stands watching and cheering, and so I think that for me, that's hard.
Triathlon is intensely physical, testing the limits in cycling, running, and open water swimming. Nancy told us that this book project gave her a fuller picture of what Gwen went through to top the podium.
She talks a lot about suffering and that to be a top athlete, you have to suffer, and kind of the whole mindset, it's a good type of suffering, but there is physical pain, and I don't think I fully realize that, and probably still don't.
Gwen switched to marathons after winning gold in Rio. In a post on Team USA's site last year, Gwen said when reconsidering a return to triathlon, her biggest hesitation was the guilt she would feel as a mom. Would she have time to spend with her young sons?
In a recent post on her YouTube channel, Gwen reflects on last season's triathlon and motherhood highlights.
You know, I was very proud that I was able to win 4 World Cups in one season. You know, as a breastfeeding mom, you know, started racing less than 4 months postpartum. Like, those things I think I'm really proud of. And if you've ever been a woman who's had a baby, I think you'd understand that.
Gwen did not earn a spot on the USA triathlon team in the Paris Games. She critiqued her performance in a crucial race in Japan.
I had, I would say, one of my worst swims based on where I am. So, yeah, I was disappointed to swim, but the reality, and I think I can swim better, but the reality is I didn't.
But Gwen did uphold her values. She wrote last year, "I want to show my five-year-old that success is more than perfection. It's striving, giving our best on that day, and showing up to try."
As for what's next in racing, Gwen has a plan.
People are always like, "Oh, you just want to go to the Olympics and be done." And that was never it. Like, I always wanted to finish the 2024 season and go after, the world championships in 2025. So that's always been on my radar.
And as a world-class athlete representing Wisconsin, Gwen Jorgensen remains one to watch out for.
It's Wisconsin Today. The 17th annual Dachshund Derby may not be as prestigious as the Olympics, but come on, who doesn't want to watch wiener dogs racing? The race is coming up on Sunday the 28th at Milwaukee's German Fest, where it's become a standout event. In addition to the race, there's an annual costume contest for the dogs. Gail Pipke is the organizer of the 17th annual Dachshund Derby, and Joe Steem's Dachshund Bean will be competing in his 10th Derby this year. Gail, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Joe, thanks for being with us.
I appreciate having me on.
Joe, let's start with you and Bean. Tell us a little bit about Bean and why you wanted to enter him into the Dachshund Derby, not just once, but year after year.
Yeah, I mean, he was a puppy. He was about a year old. I was actually doing a fostering group with volunteering for the Midwest Dachshund Rescue. And through that organization, obviously, a lot of dachshunds, people are passionate about the dachshunds and everything dachshund. So found out about German Fest, how they have the Dachshund Derby. Well, why not have my dog be a part of this? So, you know, have a one-year-old dog, get him entered in the race. And yeah, I mean, ever since then, it's been fun. Found out there was a costume contest. That was actually the first year that he won the costume contest. Unfortunately, not the race, but it was a great experience for us both.
Gail, what inspired the Dachshund Derby in the first place?
There was a gentleman who, I don't think that he owned wiener dogs, but he just decided that this should be a good thing to have at German Fest. And it started 17 years ago, and it's been taken over by, people who love the wiener dogs and love seeing them race. It's just fun to do because they're not bred to race. So I think that's the fun part, is that you get these dogs that either they just stand there, they turn around, or they look like little lightning machines, just like they've been shot out of a cannon, and they just go because they want their squeaky toy back and their owner stole it, or they are racing for food. So, and you have the ones that are just dawdling along, picking up any scraps, anything that's on the ground. So it's just entertaining for everybody that goes to get to watch them.
Yeah, Joe, you have shared some video of the event. And yeah, definitely, as Gail said, sometimes the dogs in the race don't race. I saw sometimes dachshunds not in that particular heat of the race would jump in once they saw other dogs running. How does Bean do? Where does Bean fall into that?
I have a ball that Bean is obsessed with, some squeaky toys, some of the really smelly treats. So I wave it in front of his face, walk down to the finish line. He can't take his eyes off of me, or mostly the ball and the treats. But once it's the 1, 2, 3, go, he runs, usually does very well. But then there's another heat of dogs that are in the same age group that go again. So then he has to go the second time. And usually by that second time, when it's all the winners kind of racing against one another, he's a little over it, I would say, where he'll not go quite as fast. But yeah, so he knows he can let up a little bit. He'll still get his treat. He'll get his toy. But I think he does like the attention of everybody. So I don't fault him for that.
And Gail, how many dogs do you expect, this time around? How many dogs tend to participate?
We are limited to 100 because of insurance liability purposes. So we are right at 100.
I want to see that insurance guideline. You can race up to and including 100 dachshunds. 101, forget about
sometimes
it. The cost triple.
Yeah, sometimes some get sick the day of, or they don't show up, or traffic, or, there's always a reason. But it's usually, it's a lot of dogs.
Yeah.
It's a lot. there. So especially when they start barking and it's funny too when the police dogs happen to be like next to us in a booth, and when they, you know, they go to water their dogs, and then the wiener dogs are, rah, you know, going after the police dog, and you're like, really? Do you want to push that button? I don't think so.
We're talking about the Dachshund Derby, takes place at Milwaukee's German Festival coming up this year, July 28th. Gail Pipke, organizer of the 17th annual Dachshund Derby. Joe Steams, Dachshund Bean, will be competing 10th time around. Joe, the costume contest. What costumes have you and Bean come up with in the past?
Well, the two that he's won, he's had, he was the bratwurst for the Brewers Racing Sausages. So he did that when he was in his first go around. He tried to bring it back again last year, now that he was a little bit bigger and had to make a new costume because he filled out his girth a little bit more than when he was a puppy.
I can relate.
But he was also in 2014, I believe it was, Germany won the World Cup for soccer. Mm-hmm. And being made out of a onesie. It was a custom screen print with his name on it as well, a little short, little soccer uniform, and he likes to play soccer, so he was kicking the soccer ball around. Those were a couple. He was a pretzel 1 year. He was a world's longest dachshund 1 year.
Gail, you are one of the judges, and we won't preview Bean's costume this year. I don't want to prejudice the judge here, but how hard is it? How tough is the costume competition?
Well, there's usually three of us that judge, and we look for a German theme, obviously. We like creativity, so better than the store-bought, uniforms. But it's just fun seeing them dressed up. And I remember being in that longest dachshund costume, because it was like 20 feet long, dragging behind him with these little legs. I mean, it's hilarious to see what they come up with.
Gail, getting back to the races now, this isn't a 100 dachshund free-for-all. They're different age group categories, mm-hmm. right?
There is. We start with the puppies. They tend to be the ones that just sort of sit there and go, I don't know what I'm supposed to do, and just look at their owners. And so in one of the years, we actually had to have the owners just carry the dogs down to the end because the little babies, they just didn't know what to do. We usually have some dogs that maybe once they were paralyzed, they're walking again, but maybe they can't run. So they walk a little bit slower, or we've got some cart dogs, meaning that they are paralyzed from the waist down and they are in like the little wheel cart devices. And so they're still able to race, but they just couldn't, they can't win against a dog like Bean.
Joe, for human races, which I don't do myself, but I understand people train, right, to get ready for the race. Is there a training, an athletic training regimen for Bean?
I would say he has informal training. He's he likes to play soccer, so he kicks a ball around with his little paws and moves it around with his nose. So anybody that comes into the house, they always get greeted with a ball into their ankle. The official training is something that I would say he probably doesn't always want to do unless there is the food or toy involved with that.
All right, we'll leave it there. Have a great event. Joe, thanks for joining us today.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And Gail, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Gail Pipke is the organizer of the 17th annual Dachshund Derby. Joe Steams, Dachshund Bean, will compete in his 10th Derby this year. The event takes place on Sunday, July 28th at Milwaukee's German Fest. Hey, the Summer Olympics kick off in 1 week here on Wisconsin Today. We'll hear from some Wisconsin members of Team USA in the Olympics and Paralympics in Paris. Now we want to hear from you. Will you be watching? Is there a particular event that you have your eye on? Basketball or badminton, gymnastics or judo, swimming or squash? Let us know your Olympic plans. Call or text at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232 or email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. And if you're in the Olympics, why are you listening to me? Get back to your training. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.